Welcome to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wudun are both Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists. They're also a married couple who have written several books together, including Half the Sky and A Path Appears. Their latest book is Tightrope, Americans Reaching for Hope. It focuses on the decline of the American working class from the perspective of Nicholas's childhood hometown, Yamhill, Oregon. Nicholas and Cheryl talk this hour with Nate Payne, editor of the Traverse City Record Eagle. Nate asked Cheryl how she and Nicholas balance their writing and married life.
Well, it only works because I write the odd pages and he writes the even pages. So we keep it separate. No, seriously, it really helps that I'm a former journalist, but it really helps that we're both journalists. We're very accustomed to editing, and so we are totally happy editing each other, and that's really what makes it work.
All right. So can I also just say that it is kind of cool as a kid who raised cherries on, you know, growing up, to be in Traverse City. Although, truth be told, in Oregon, those of us who raised sour cherries, when we mentioned Northern Michigan, it was not always in glowing terms. And typically, you know, we'd have a great bumper crop, and we'd be looking forward to a great big check, and then there'd be these whispers that Michigan had a good crop, and we'd be thinking, oh no, that's going to ruin the cherry price. But today, in the spirits of common cherry growing and cherry pie eating, I will be willing to overlook these differences.
So you went into your careers and you lived around the world. The broad focus of your work has been international. Can you touch on some of the milestones, the really important milestones that have educated your work and gotten you back to this?
Well, a lot of it really started as we were foreign correspondents based in China and then in Japan. And then Nick actually, when he became a columnist around the world, and we were basically traveling around covering all sorts of things, including humanitarian crises, we would come back every year and go to Yamhill, Oregon. And I've been going there for decades. I know, you know, so many people there. And as, you know, time went on, we started realizing that there is a humanitarian crisis unfolding in Yamhill too. And it was just really surprising and horrifying to us. These are people who we knew quite well, and we had never really delved into their backgrounds. We had never really probed. It wasn't polite, but we would see them very frequently and smile and have polite talk. And as we started asking more about their backgrounds, and they basically opened the door to their homes, and we went inside, and it was so sad and tragic, and what we saw a lot of pain and suffering. I mean, it really comes down to the fact that here, in America, we may have running water, we certainly have plumbing and electricity, even flat screen TVs. But one thing, and it's a real paradox, that many working class people don't have here is hope. And you can look at all of these people around the world scrambling, desperately trying to get into the US because they believe in the American dream. They believe so fervently that if they got to the Golden Mountain, as they call it in Chinese, that they could have a really good life. But for here, in America, the homegrown Americans who are floundering in the working class, for them, this dream does not exist. It's broken.
So you run through that progression of sort of the generational change. Can you give us a rundown of what you found as the breakpoint?
When everything changed, basically?
Yeah, and away from prosperity or away from at least working class security.
Yeah. So Yamhill, like I think a lot of places, had done exceptionally well for decade after decade after decade. And so everybody was very optimistic. On my number six school bus, we all thought that life was going to continue to improve. Kids were going to do better off than their parents had. In the in the 1970s, about 90% of kids were doing better than their parents had as of age 30. And then I'd say that it was in the late 70s that things began to collapse, and partly that was that some jobs moved away, manufacturing jobs, agriculture consolidated, lumber, sawmills consolidated. And it was also that unions began to lose power vis-a-vis corporations, so that earnings for blue-collar workers tended to stagnate, so that for about the bottom half of the labor force, earnings now are no greater than they were in the 1970s. The minimum wage stagnated. If the federal minimum wage of 1968 had kept pace with inflation and productivity, it'd now be more than $22 instead of $7.25 an hour. And then we also embarked on the war on drugs and mass incarceration at precisely a time when there were an awful lot of men in particular who were floundering in the labor market, who felt inadequate, who were accumulating criminal records, which compounded the sense of failure, and who self-medicated with drugs and alcohol, got records that made them less employable and less marriageable, and this cycle just spiraled downhill very quickly.
So as you started to inspect these kids on the bus who you grew up around, what percentage would you say didn't at least break even to their parents' prosperity?
I'd say that, so on my number six school bus, well, a quarter of the kids who were on the bus with me are now gone from drugs, alcohol, suicide-related pathologies, a quarter. There are many more who are homeless, in jail, struggling, floundering. There are some, though, who have done extraordinarily well. And if you look at Cheryl and I as an experiment, we were looking at my old high school yearbooks. If you look at the kids in National Honor Society at that photo, they have done fine. They have done just great. Mostly they've left the area, I'd say. There were some who joined the military. They mostly did just fine. They did great. They learned technical skills. They did well. But, I mean, I'd say that it was, you know, maybe a third who did just great and largely predictable on their parents' situation. I mean, I'd say there was an almost perfect correlation with how many children's books were in their houses as kids or how often they were read to and their eventual outcomes.
So, Cheryl, you were a relative outsider coming in at a point in time, so as maybe with a more of a reporter's view. I mean, I think we can understand that the perspective is much different at the point you come in. So what were the differences between the way you viewed the same people and the way Nicholas viewed the same people?
I think that ultimately we, you know, came to a similar understanding, and that's reflected in Tightrope. But I think that for me, I could really see the enormity of the dysfunction, and that it was so penetrating that it shocked me, because I hadn't appreciated in the richest country in the world, how many people could be living in such pain and suffering. I mean, you know, it's to the point where we know nationally the statistics are such that there are deaths of despair that are reduced the American life expectancy for 3 years in a row. Thankfully, more recently, the 2018 figures showed a slight upward tick, but the underlying trend is still that the deaths of despair are still a negative trend. And those three causes for deaths of despair are alcohol-related deaths, deaths from overdose related to drugs, and then suicides. So we saw that in Yamhill. And so for me, actually, you know, just looking at Yamhill, thinking this is almost like covering a developing country. I mean, I was like, how could this be in in the wealthiest country in the world. And so I really, you know, looked at it from that point of view. It was quite surprising. And you know, Nick can talk about his point of view, but I'd say that it really is in line with statistics, and it made it easier for me to actually corroborate some of the facts that we're seeing in other places in the U.S.
So, I guess, Nick, when you went back, who were the people who gripped you most that you can recall as a school-age kid and revisit?
The kids who got on the school bus right after I did were the Knapp kids, five kids. Farlan was my year, and then his brother Zeelan, sister Regina, his brother Nathan, his brother Keelan. They were a family that had done exceptionally well in recent decades. Their dad had a good union job laying sewer pipes. Their mom had a job driving tractor on a hazelnut farm. They bought their own place. When Farlan turned 16, his parents scrounged and bought him a Ford Mustang, and we were all so jealous of Farlan. But Farlan died of liver failure from drug and alcohol, after years of drug and alcohol abuse, compounded when he lost his job. And Zeelan died in a house fire when he was passed out drunk. Regina died of hepatitis from needle use. Nathan blew himself up cooking meth, and Keelan survived only because he had spent 13 years in the state penitentiary. And it's just very hard to see these kids you remember as so ebullient in this family that symbolized upward mobility just crash one after the other. And what I had not been really aware of until we started reporting for Tightrope was the consequences for their children. So Farlan had two daughters. One died from alcoholism at age 29. The other, she's so smart. She's so talented. She was the first in the family ever to graduate from high school. She's so self-possessed. And we were sure she'd had problems with drugs and with prison and mental health issues, but she was very self-aware. We thought she was gonna make it, and we were texting with her to get pictures of Farlan for the book, and then suddenly she wasn't responding to texts, and then her daughter answered that mom's back in jail. And, you know, just to see the way the burdens were transmitted to the next generation. And that, I think, was one thing that, one reason we wanted to write it, that we saw, you know, it's too late to help the kids on the number six bus, but there are so many kids who are growing up in these toxic, dysfunctional, chaotic households. One child every 15 minutes is born in America with a dependency on opioids. One in seven kids in America is living in a household with a parent who has a dependency. And we can help these kids. We can make a difference in those lives, but we have to act when they're young. And I don't think the country is aware of the scale of the challenge.
I think what's really important to note is that economic mobility in this country has really been stymied for the working class. It is terrific for, you know, people in the upper class, even the middle class, but it is stymied for the people in the working class. And there are even surveys that show, at first, you know, a while back it was 50% of adults don't think that their kids will, you know, do better than they. Now it's 76% of adults don't think that their kids' generation will do better. And if you look at the Knapp family, Dee Knapp, she is still alive and doing fine. She's, you know, in her early 80s. Her mom recently died at 97. Very recently. So you can see, you know, even with her generation, her kids obviously did not do as well as her generation, and their kids are also, you know, not doing very well either. So that's economic dismobility. I mean, it's really downward mobility.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, more of Nate Payne's conversation with Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to Nate Payne's conversation with Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn.
This idea of adverse childhood experiences contributing to trajectories is interesting, and I think it's something that journalists, particularly local journalists, see all the time in court documents and in real life reporting, and it's very hard to convey. And I think you had a number of really interesting and poignant passages here, but I think this is one I think you could find in almost every newspaper in middle America. This is talking about Rebecca Hale's daughter. Once when Chloe and Nate were home, these are her children, an angry boyfriend started beating their mom. The boyfriend cut Rebecca's throat and face badly. Another time, he took a hammer and shattered her arm and hand, threatened to smash her head. Whenever violence flared, Chloe and Nate would rush to their bedroom, crawl out the window, and run down the street to their grandmother's house to summon help. Did you expect to write about that in America?
That was a really shocking discussion when we were talking with Rebecca, because here was a woman who had so many problems growing up. Her mom was doing drugs when she was little. She was basically she was actually homeless in the first grade. And then her father, who was also an alcoholic, ended up going back into jail. So her mom was in jail, then her father was in jail, and so she basically had no place to go. She was put into a foster home, a children's home. So she had been in and out of difficulties. And, you know, it's the struggles of people like Rebecca that really surprise us, because here Rebecca in the ninth grade, she had the self-possession to actually go get the forms to register for high school and go to her mom, get them signed, and bring them to the high school to enroll. And the teachers there said, "Oh, where's your mom?" She goes, "Oh, she can't make it," because she was in jail. "She can't make it. I'm sorry, your mom has to accompany you in order to enroll you in school." Here's a girl who wants to go to school, and she can't because her mom's in jail, and she's too embarrassed to say that. And so when the teacher says, "I'm going to go call the police," and Rebecca just says, "I have to go to the bathroom," and she runs out the bathroom window. She just, escapes. And then, of course, her life is full of strife, and she's, abused by her boyfriend. And then you worry that the next generation, Chloe and Nate, are also going to be messed up as well. And so, luckily, Rebecca was in a program in Tulsa called Women in Recovery that takes women who basically are destined for jail, but because the underlying reason for them having committed the crime is that they have an addiction. And so Women in Recovery says, if we think this woman is really committed to wanting to change, and if we think that she can be rehabilitated through drug treatment, we'll take her. And they took her. It was 2 years. She finished actually in 18 months. She was so committed. It's full time. Every single day, they go through intense psychotherapy, they go through classes, all sorts of classes with their kids as well, so that they can actually repair the kids, because they know the next generation is really important. And then they go through job training, and they go get apprenticeships and get a job. And so she becomes a fully productive member of society when she graduates, instead of spending several years in jail and incurring all the costs of in prison. And so there are solutions, and that's what's really exciting, is that there are solutions. We just need them to be replicated across the country.
How common are those solutions, and what's the spread of them like? What what were you finding?
Well, okay. Well, just quickly, basically, 1 in 10 people who have a substance abuse get treatment, instead of, and the other 90% don't. So it's almost like if you compare it to if you have diabetes and only 10% of them get insulin, we wouldn't tolerate that. And so, but we do tolerate that when it has to do with drug treatment.
You know, I'd say that we have a whole chapter on solutions, so to speak. But I think that in America, maybe the starting point is that we need a new social narrative. And I think that we have obsessed with a narrative of personal responsibility over 50 years that has actually impeded wiser policy, that has tended to point fingers rather than offering helping hands. And if you think about those children with adverse childhood experiences you mentioned, then it is entirely true that plenty of people who are in trouble make bad choices and exercise irresponsible behavior. I mean, Farlan should not have dropped out of high school. He should not have been involved in meth, et cetera, et cetera. But a lot of kids are programmed toward making bad decisions from a very young age. And we have toolboxes that can influence their decisions. And I just find it deeply offensive that we have ways to help kids and we can save money on these interventions, and yet we still don't, and instead stick with pointing fingers. It seems almost gratuitously cruel to indulge in blaming people when we can help. And so that's why I would argue that it needs to start with a new narrative, a new social narrative that is less about personal responsibility, while accepting that that is real, and more about what we call a morality of grace, about trying to figure out how together we can address some of these issues. By all means, we can have the conversation about personal responsibility, but let's also have a conversation about collective social responsibility.
I mean, there's also a self-interest here in the sense that when we wrote Half the Sky, we were talking about all, the turning oppression into opportunity, because so many women around the world were being oppressed. And if you actually unleash and give them opportunity and empower them, they can be a huge economic force. And the same thing is true of working class America. I mean, there are so many people who are basically trapped and disempowered, and if you actually can empower them, give them opportunity, they can be a huge economic force as well. We're not living up to the potential that America can be.
So let's talk for a minute about bootstrapping. I mean, this idea, what is the psychology around bootstrapping? What have you learned? What's your...
the paradox is that this notion of picking yourself up by the bootstraps, that originally meant exactly the opposite of what it means today. So if you look in old dictionaries at this phrase, then in the 18th century and in the 19th centuries, it meant to do something impossible. And it was only in the 20th century that it came to be this kind of edict that you should lift yourself up to a higher status level. And of course, the first understanding was correct. You have to have a pretty flawed understanding of physics to think that you can actually lift yourself up by the bootstraps. And it does more broadly, I think, reflect this narrative that I think is profoundly wrong of instructing somebody to do something that is essentially impossible. In Oregon, we were nurtured on all these stories about our pioneer ancestors, these heroes crossing the country, courageous, and they would never accept benefits, or they are totally relying on themselves. And indeed, they were incredibly courageous. They were heroic, no doubt about that. But why did they cross the country to go to the Willamette Valley? Because of a government benefit plan, because they knew once they got to the Willamette Valley, they'd get 640 acres of great land to plant sour cherries.
The Homestead Acts.
And indeed, it was because of the Homestead Acts later because of rural electrification, later the GI Bill of Rights, that completely transformed places like Yamhill and, I'm guessing, northern Michigan as well. And those were examples of enlightened government programs that created wealth, that created human capital in a collective way, that recognized the power of individual creativity and initiative and sought to create incentives that benefited those individuals and the country as well.
When we're talking about the people who struggled, who you wrote about, tell us a little bit about how you reconciled those characters, how you got all of it out without glazing over things or creating characters that really aren't warts and all.
This was something we struggled with because these were our friends, and we felt a journalistic need to depict those warts and those mistakes. And yet, we also cared about how they would see what we had written and their families and other people in Yamhill. And we also cared about how other readers, when they read what we had written, whether they would see our friends. And we talk about our friend Clayton Green, and we have photos of Clayton. And he's this 400-pound guy with long hair who, for a while, cooked meth. And he screwed up in lots of ways. But we didn't want people just to see that, when we also knew him as this deeply loyal friend, as this brilliant mechanic, as this very capable guy. And we wanted people to see him in this fully rounded way. And we asked Clayton about saying in the book how much he had earned cooking meth. And initially, he didn't want us to write about that. And we argued that, look, this is part of who you are. If people want to understand it, then that's part of it. And he thought about it for a couple of weeks, and then he agreed. And there were so many people in Yamhill who trusted us by telling things that were deeply embarrassing. We hope we did justice to their trust, and we hope that readers will see and recognize people who absolutely have flaws, but also have courage and greatness, and that one aspect of that courage was being willing to share some things that they might not want to talk about, but wanted the public to understand in hopes that it might lead to wiser and more compassionate policy.
Why do you think they were willing to share so much? Was it because of their relationship with the two of you and because they knew you being there a significant amount, or was it because of that greater good idea?
You know, I think that there are several things, and it's different for different people, but by and large, I think that, first of all, they felt that someone was listening to them. They, you know, were really happy that someone cared about what they thought, what they were feeling, what they were going through. And I think they also felt that they wanted other people to know that you shouldn't do this kind of thing, that it that really is to help ward off. If my story can help other people, I'd feel really good. And I think that's, you know, there were a number of people, some of them who we didn't even put in the book, who really felt, and they went so deeply into their story that, you know, boy, I'd like to be able to help someone else. So for them, it's kind of a little bit of helping other people. I think they wanted to help other people. And that's very moving. That was very moving to us.
So why this book and why this book now? I think that, you know, you, the two of you are at a place in your career where you could pick anywhere in the world to write about a significant issue. Why this one?
So we could have written a Trump book. And, you know, I mean, a Trump book is just a guaranteed bestseller. I mean, you cannot... You know, I know that I can write a Trump column, and I can pretty much write a Trump column at this point by hitting F5 on my keyboard. you know the journalistic shortcut there. But at the end of the day, when we write those books or those columns, we're unlikely to change minds or really have influence. and where I think that we as journalists or as writers do fundamentally have an impact is not when we address things that are on the agenda and try to change people's minds about abortion or guns or Trump, but rather when we take a spotlight and we try to illuminate something that is not on the agenda and project it onto the agenda. And right now, Cheryl and I felt that there is something like the Great Depression that is afflicting millions of Americans to the point that life expectancy in America is actually dropping, or was dropping for 3 years, which did not happen in the Great Depression. The Great Depression, life expectancy still rose. So it was this dramatic effect affecting tens of millions of homes, of households in America, and yet it was as if much of the country was oblivious. In the Great Depression, there was this major response. We had the New Deal. Everybody was aware of it. It felt like this time, not only was there not really a policy response to mitigate the problems, if anything, policy sometimes exacerbated the problems, and that a lot of the country in the first-class cabin was completely unaware of how much wrenching distress there was in much of the country. So I think there's something we can learn from people wrestling with addiction. And the two things that people who are wrestling with those issues need to understand is, first, they have to face up to the scale of the problem, that they have an addiction, that this is serious. This isn't something they control. It controls them. And the second thing they have to understand is that there is a pathway out, that there is hope, that they can turn it around. And I think likewise, the U.S. has to face the scale of the problem, and it also has to understand that it's not hopeless, that we can lick these problems, that we can indeed, especially if we intervene with kids, we can make a dramatic difference. And so those are kind of the messages of Tightrope, and we hope that we can help convey that either by having people read it or by whacking them over the head with it.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn talk about how they say the U.S. could solve its problems with a working class population.
Listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Let's return to Nate Payne's conversation with Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn, authors of Tightrope, Americans Reaching for Hope.
We actually did start out with one of the questions in our reporting to be basically, why did people vote for Trump? And so that led us to, obviously, because Yamhill is a very, very, you know, red area, and a lot of other places that we went to are very red. And so we were asking people, why is it? But then as we were doing the reporting, it became so much deeper because we started to realize the extent of the challenges and the pain and the suffering that so many of these people were facing. And, you know, it was just so much deeper a problem you know, Trump was just kind of, he's a symptom. You know, the fact that they voted for him was a symptom of what they were feeling. And it comes down to the loss of jobs, which I'd say is probably the most important factor that has led to this widespread, you know, depression. And look, we think, okay, well, you got to find a job, but you know, no one else is going to find a job for you, right? But on the other hand, if you look at other countries, they've been beset by globalization just like we have. They've been beset by automation just like we have. But they don't have this kind of social depression that we have here. So they are doing something differently. You know, let me give you an example because it's very close to home. Not, you know, closer to Traverse City than from New York. But after the financial crisis, you had auto workers laid off in Detroit and in Windsor, Ontario, Canada. And so we got to see the difference, and sometimes it was by the same company. So you got to see the different responses. So in Detroit, because of the, you know, a severe nature of the financial crisis, they extended unemployment benefits. So these laid off workers got more money. But because they lost their job, they also lost their health care. So that was a huge stressor on the family. You know, over in Canada, well, those families, they did get laid off, they lost their job, but they didn't lose their health care. They still had health care, which took removed a huge amount of stress. And then also the government kicked into action. They intervened and they looked around the area to see where there was a demand for what kind of jobs, and they discovered that nursing was an area where there was a demand. So they put together these training, retraining programs, taking these welders and these technicians and actually trying to teach them, you know, jobs that would help them in nursing. And so these, as a result, auto workers were then reintegrated back into the workday world much more quickly than in Detroit. And also, you know, years later, the Canadians, they were not embroiled or entangled in self-medication, in, you know, in depression and loneliness. And those are real factors. I mean, loneliness, by the way, is afflicting America as well. And it's as powerful a depressant as to your health as 15 cigarettes a day, loneliness. And so there is an epidemic of loneliness as well, and part of it also has to do with job loss and not being able to, you know, find new work. And it's not just the income loss, it's also the loss of identity. Jobs for males in particular, middle-aged men, the loss of a job is the loss of your identity.
So do you think, you know, these social policies that you've laid out and that you're advocating for, the people who you started the book with, would they support them?
So it's sort of interesting. I mean, the white working class tends to be socially deeply conservative. So on issues of abortion, guns, they tend to be profoundly conservative. On economic issues, though, they're not. So when the issue is the minimum wage, if it's parental leave, childhood programs, better schools, and, well, Medicaid expansion is an area that's kind of up for grabs, but increasingly the white working class has been in favor of expanding Medicaid, then they're much more open to those ideas. I mean, it is striking that the two politicians who have resonated most with the white working class have been Donald Trump on the right and Bernie Sanders on the left, who have nothing in common ideologically, but both are populists who kind of criticize the system. And so one of the things, and I guess one of the things that I really worry about at this time politically, is that Donald Trump and impeachment suck all the oxygen out of the room, and that all we talk about now are Trump and impeachment. And these problems predated Trump. They will be around after Trump is gone. Trump and impeachment are enormously important. I write about them all the time. But there are other things that are also important. And we have to save bandwidth for those issues as well. And that is going to be one of the challenges in this campaign coming up. This is a moment when we can highlight some of these larger structural needs for the country. I hope that we in the media and the public more broadly, that we do take this occasion of a campaign to highlight some of these, this broader need for corrections.
Do you think these social issues get enough coverage nationwide?
No, they don't at all. And I think it partly it is because, you know, people don't write about the working class, period. I mean, they you know, give a bone to them, and certainly some of the candidates, they do mention, oh, I'm fighting for the working class, but how often, you know, are they really, they'll go into a diner in the working class neighborhood, but, you know, how often are they going into the homes of working class people or, you know, stopping by the farm and actually, you know, talking to people on the farm? And I wish they would do more of that, because I do think that they would actually be able to persuade some of these people that they're not demons and they're not going to be socialists and take away your private property. But, you know, I do think that the problem with mainstream media is that they cover news. And as you well know, news happened yesterday. It was a big event that you write about. But, you know, these things are very incremental. So the life expectancy dropping for the third year in a row, it's happening a little bit every single day, each of those 3 years. And it's only when, oh my goodness, the third year in a row, it's a crisis. By that time, you'll write about it. But by then, it's like, wait a second, we had 3 years and we weren't doing anything. Are we going to do something now? And so I think that the media has to really change its framework. And there are, you know, attempts, but I would not say that it's enough.
I would just add that I completely agree with that. And I would just add that two of the biggest stories over the last 20 years, ones that I covered a great deal as well, were the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. I spent a lot of time in Afghanistan, a lot of time in Iraq. These really were enormously important. But every 2 weeks, we now lose more Americans to drugs, alcohol, and suicide than we lost in 18 years collectively in Iraq and Afghanistan. And those deaths don't get adequate coverage. So I do think this is an issue that we have fumbled.
So where do we go from here? You've laid out solutions and things that you think people should adopt. Clearly, we're a polarized nation. Are those achievable? And is that something that you...
Well, a lot of these solutions that we actually propose, they're actually operating somewhere. I mean, we are in the age of innovation when it comes to research on social policies. And so we have so much to pick and choose from, which is terrific. I mean, you know, 50 years ago, it was a greenfield. No one really knew. But now we have a lot of research and randomized controlled trials that show what works and what doesn't. And so we do, as a nation, need to recorrect our path. So, for instance, when it comes to drug treatment, it's very interesting to see how Portugal handled this, you know, decades ago versus, you know, the U.S. The U.S. launched the war on drugs and mass incarceration of people who violated the drug laws. And so in Portugal, they said, well, no, a lot of these people, at least the small bit drug mules, they don't belong in prison. They actually need drug treatment. So they used the public health, you know, toolkit and actually started treating these people because they needed drug treatment and didn't incur the cost of jail. And it turns out that it works. So they, you know, Portugal has cut down its, you know, numbers of, you know, heroin users by 2/3, drug users by 2/3. And it also has the lowest rate of drug use. It's not zero, but it has the lowest rate in Western Europe, which is a stunning comparison to us. What happened, you know, here in the U.S., we actually have soaring, drug use rates, and deaths of despair, because those are the three driving, you know, well, suicides, but overdose of drugs and alcohol-related deaths are driving the decline in life expectancy. So we as a nation have to learn how to recorrect when things are proven wrong. Our system should be flexible. We used to pride ourselves in having a very flexible system, but we have so many rigidities now that I do worry that we are going to fall behind the rest of the world. I mean, we have already fallen behind the rest of the world on many metrics that we talk about in Tyro.
We've been a little grim perhaps so far. So can I offer you a pick-me-up? Around the time that I was growing up in Yamhill, there was a girl growing up in a working class family in Southern Oregon named Anne, who we write about. And Anne went to Ashland High School, the oldest of five kids. Nobody in her family had ever gone to college. She was a smart girl, and spring of senior year, her English teacher, Hattie Converse, stops her in the hall and says, "Anne, where are you going to college?" and says, you know, I can't go to college. Mrs. Converse more or less drags her to the school office and says, Ann, you are going to college, and here's the application forms. It's too late for, you've missed the deadline for most places, but you can still apply to the University of Oregon. And she pretty much bullies poor Ann into applying to University of Oregon. Ann does so. She wins a scholarship. She goes to University of Oregon. She studies journalism. It's hard thing to do. She's working part-time as a hotel maid, as in restaurants, all kinds of jobs, but she graduates in journalism. She gets a job at a local TV station, moves on from there, and Ann Curry ended up at the Today Show because of a nudge from Mrs. Converse. And there are so many other Ann Curries around Oregon, around Michigan, all over the country, with such potential. And we can't put a Mrs. Converse in every hallway, but there are ways of providing those kinds of nudges, those kind of supports, in ways that benefit not only the Ann Curries, but benefit all of society by having a chance to exploit that kind of potential.
And that's why we say that, in, you know, very similar, you, if you can empower all these other Americans, we often think of them, oh, they're just deadbeat Americans. No, if you can actually empower them and unleash opportunity for them, them reaching their full potential would really be a significant driving force for the American economy and for American greatness.
You touched on Putnam's bowling alone. You know, this idea of the sort of disintegrating American community, which is the symptom and which is the cause?
So I think it cuts both ways. And this was something we wondered a lot about, because if we argue that the disintegration in places like Yamhill was driven by the loss of jobs, then why did that disintegration of the social fabric not happen during the Great Depression in the 1930s, in Yamhill or in other ways? Why did life expectancy not fall then? Why did crime not increase then? And we think that the answer was that in the 1930s, there were very robust social institutions, churches, community organizations that provided a buffer, that provided support, and that those gradually withered away for especially the people who needed them most. And so that a lot of the families we write about really were suffering from an intense social isolation, from that loneliness that Cheryl described, and that not only, so that was sort of one cause-effect relationship, but it also went the other way, because nothing is more toxic for social institutions, for social fabric, for social capital than drug addictions. And in places like Yamhill, when people were wrestling with addictions, they lied, they stole, they just could not be trusted. And there were very, very few institutions that could handle that. The Mormon Church, actually, was one of the very few that provided essentially complete protection and immunity to kids who were members of the church. Others, for the most part, did not.
Do people in your circles, in New York, or intellectual circles, or your regular readers, do they understand what is happening in Middle America?
Well, we hope that tightrope actually will be a wake-up call for them. I don't fault them. I mean, we didn't understand the extent of these problems until we actually, you know, did the reporting for Tightrope. And, you know, so, you know, we do live in bubbles. I mean, it's pretty remarkable how lack of empathy is the result of the bubbles that we live in. We, you know, we have our own white picket fence, you know, and our own house that is surrounded by other houses that are just as, you know, well-to-do, and we live in communities that are gated or that are, you know, at least ensconced in areas very far away from people in different classes, and so the result is that we don't see need. And one interesting reflection of that is that people at the top 20% of the income brackets, They give less as a percentage of total income to charity than people in the bottom 20% of the income bracket, which is odd. You'd think, well, people, you know, at the top 20 has so much more money to give. Why aren't they? And a lot of it is because, you know, when you're in the bottom 20%, you live in a neighborhood where there is need constantly, and when people approach you, you respond. When you see need, you respond. Whereas people in the top 20% don't see need. And so, you know, that yes, they will give, you know, charitably, but they don't see the need. So it's not as though, you know, they're opening their pockets all the time. And so, because we don't think that they're less empathetic, it's just that they're more isolated from the need.
You ready for questions?
Sure.
I think we can pivot to the crowd.
Easy questions to me, hard questions to Cheryl, our division of labor.
Hi, Cheryl and Nick. I'm wondering if you can leave us with something we need to be thinking about when we read the New York Times. What do you know that you want us to know as we read that newspaper?
I would just emphasize that with any newspaper, we cover what happened yesterday. But some of the most important things in life don't happen on any particular day. They happen every day. They have these broad trends. So one of the most important things that happened in the late 19th and early 20th century was the huge investments in American education that laid the groundwork for the rise of America to be the world's biggest economy. I think that over the last 50 years, some of the most important things that happened were the disinvestment in American human capital that I think have undermined our economy and undermined our future. If we try to think how we can make America more competitive with the rest of the world, it's not going to come from tougher negotiations with China on intellectual property protections. It's going to come from investing in American kids.
So I would... I would just have one parting thought, which would be to try and put yourself in the shoes of someone on the opposite side of the political spectrum or the opposite side of the class spectrum, and just try and think of what they're going through and what life is like from their point of view, and maybe even reach out to one or two people who are on the opposite side of the political spectrum and the opposite side of the class spectrum.
Thank you both for spending this evening with us and venturing north.
Thanks so much. We're delighted to be here.
That was Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn talking with Nate Payne. Nicholas and Cheryl wrote their latest book together called Tightrope, Americans Reaching for Hope. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org and listen to past programs at interlockinpublicradio.org. For Interlock and Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerich.